Good morning, and the conversation begins here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. It's in the low 70s now, but it's going to get hot, and it's already humid. So no matter where you go, take 94 WIP with you. You'll always have cool conversation throughout the day. And when we come back in just a bit, when we're kids, we have big dreams. We move into adolescence and young adulthood, and something happens. Somehow those dreams get lost. But we're going to figure out in just a bit what we do to get those dreams back. All those and more when we come back here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. More in just a bit. And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, radio show host, columnist, Lillian McDermott. And it's been said that what happens to a dream deferred? It dries up like a raisin in the sun. Well, how to keep your dreams from drying up like a raisin in the sun is one of the things we're going to talk about with Lillian McDermott. Good morning, Lillian. Good morning, Lillian McDermott.
Hello, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
Dreams can dry up if we're not careful, can't they?
Absolutely. I've never heard it referred to as a raisin, so that's brilliant. I like that new analogy.
That actually comes from Langston Hughes, the poet.
Oh, does it?
Yes.
I have to check it out. That's okay. Great.
What are you talking about in your new book?
Well, my book I wrote a while ago as a result of many interviews. I do an interview every day, and I was doing an interview on depression and anxiety. And that whole week, people were talking to me about, I'm depressed, I'm anxious. And so the guy was a psychologist that I was interviewing, and I had casually mentioned this to him. We were talking about connection to self and self-esteem. And he said that people who are depressed and anxious are not connected to self. And so the book that I have is the 90-Day Challenge to Self-Love ebook that I give away when people become subscriber to my show. That is something that I created then. I created the 90-Day Challenge to Self-Love. I said, you know, we need to stop this, and we need to focus on who we are and what we want, that connection to self, connection to a higher power. And so I asked him, I said, if I create this, will you supervise it? And so he said, absolutely, I'll do it. So I started working on it, on how would I want to reconnect with myself. And that's how the book came about. So it's the 90-Day Challenge to Self-Love ebook that is free for people to join. Anybody who's listening to the show can, if they join my website at whenyouneedafriend.com, will get a free copy of this book.
But many people don't like themselves, do they?
You know, it's not that they don't like themselves consciously, is that it happens subconsciously or unconsciously, because what happens is from the moment we're born to about the age of 7, and I say because I was a late bloomer, for me it was the age of 10, whatever we see from that point, we're like little human paper quarters in what someone said theta mode, which is a hypnotic state. So when we're little, from the moment we're born to the moment that we hit that 7-10-year-old range, we record everything. And so whatever we record in that 7-year-old mind then gets recorded into what becomes our subconscious mind. And these are tapes that play in our head without us even knowing. And we have about 70,000 thoughts, Peter, and those 70,000 thoughts are not necessarily new. 90% of them are repetitive. And here's what just blew me away when I learned this information from Dr. Bruce Lipton. He was on my show several times. 80% of those thoughts are negative. So what happens is these tapes are playing in our head, and we don't even know it's happening. It's subconscious at this point. So the trick is, now what we need to do is, I don't know if you remember when I was older, I don't know about you, but I remember having to tape record a song on the radio on my little tape recorder, and I would run to when the music would come on, and I'd press my record button and record the song, and then I was just so excited because I would be able to listen to that song over and over again. But then when a new song would come over, would come on the air and it'd become a great hit, you could rewind that tape, rewind it, and re-record over it. If you didn't take that little tab, remember that tab, Peter, in the back of the... Yes. So some people remove that little tab without even thinking about it. And so the goal is, when we work together on my radio show and what I was doing on the book, is let's rewrite that. If you've taken the little tab off, let's figure out how we can shove something in there so that we can re-record over these tapes that when we were little we made up things about ourselves. And so sometimes it's conscious that we hate each that we hate ourselves, that we just don't like ourselves for who we are, but we think we're stuck. We think that that's all we have, but the reality is we were created by our Creator so beautifully that we can change just about anything about us, but we have to be driven to do so. And that's why I have the 8 keys to living the life of our dreams.
But how do we do that? I mean, in those first 7 years, we record so many messages from mommy and daddy, from siblings, from grandma and grandpa, that are so powerful.
Yes.
How do you take away the power?
You become aware. You become aware of what you're thinking. It's almost like if you're in the river and you're floating around and the rivers are your thoughts, right? And once in a while you come across some item in the river, and then you hold on to it and you sit there and you look at it. And you look at what you want and why it is that you don't have it. Many of us can say, well, I don't want to marry an alcoholic. Or I don't want to be overweight. Or I want, instead of doing all that, you can say, well, this is what I want. I want to marry someone who's sober. Or I want to be healthy. Many times we think along the don'ts. And if you really look at the don'ts in our life, what you focus on is what you get more out of, right? So.
Right.
So that's the trick, is to kind of focus on what we want, figure out what we don't have. I have 4 little questions that we ask, the questions of responsibility. You go to whenyouneedafriend.com to the responsibility page, and there are questions that we can ask ourselves that'll coach us, or you can hire someone like me, will coach us into rewriting these tapes, focusing on what we want so that we can achieve what we want. And when you focus on what you want, you get more of what you want. The brain doesn't know the difference between do and don't. So if I'm saying don't be late, don't be late, the brain is analyzing it, is registering be late, because it doesn't recognize do or don't. It doesn't recognize fact or fiction. That's why you can go to a movie and feel anxious when you're seeing someone being chased after with a knife, because our brain doesn't know the difference. So it's becoming aware of our thoughts. It's becoming aware of what we want, and a little bit of a combination of changing our lives, changing, the 8 steps, exercise, nutrition, connecting to nature, abstinence, which is abstinence from sugar and things that don't help our body, restored sleep, connection to a higher power, as I mentioned before, gratitude, and giving back to the world, just taking these gifts and lessons that we receive and giving it back to the world. So that's basically it in a nutshell, unless you want to go into and expand a little bit on anything that I just said.
Absolutely. Now, but again, I keep coming back to that programming can be so powerful, and you've heard it so many times in so many ways, that to try and change it is at best a difficult task, if not impossible.
No, it's not impossible. And if you say it's difficult, it will be. So it all begins with a thought, Peter. So first it's a thought. That thought converts into a feeling, and that feeling converts into an action. So if we were to change our thoughts, and we become masters of our thoughts, then it is very easy to do. And so if I think it's going to be difficult, I'm going to feel hopeless, and then I'm going to act like a victim. See did you see that progression? You know, the thought, then it becomes a feeling, then it becomes an action. If I think it's hard, then I may not be as excited to face it. But if I start dealing with it and I start looking at what I want, then I will get more of that. So, yeah, we could dive a little bit deeper into our thoughts. I always say nip it in the thought. Instead of the butt, just nip it in the thought. So if we can become aware of what we're thinking, then it's not difficult. It's different. It's new. It's exciting. It could be an adventure. And getting to know yourself, that's, again, why I wrote the ebook, 90-Day Challenge to Self-Love ebook. And I wanted to give it away. I didn't want to sell it. I want everybody to have access to what I've been able to learn over the last 7 years with all the experts that I've had on my show.
So if I'm understanding you right then, Lillian, it's a question of when that voice in your head, which is probably your mother or your father or your teacher or whoever, says to you, how can you be so stupid?
Yes.
You say, because I'm human.
You know, and here we go. That's a great example, Peter, and many of us have heard that. Many of us, well-meaning parents, wonderful, salt-of-the-earth parents, will say something as dumb as that, right? I've said it. I don't know if you're a parent, but I don't know if you've said it. But that, in the mind of a child, translates to, you're dumb, you're stupid, you'll never be able to do much. Now, some other child might hear that, and they might be, watch me, I'm going to be the smartest person on the earth. And they are just naturally geared towards, watch me, I'm going to defy it, right? So if you know that you're calling yourself stupid, so what would be the antidote of that? That would be to say, I am smart, or I am clever, and start every time I hear myself, that voice in my head and that voice in my head, first of all, who is the voice in your head? You know, is it your mother? Is it your father? Figure out all the feelings that have come from that voice. You write it down. And there are four little questions, Peter, that I go through this whenever I'm feeling victimized, whenever I'm feeling that I'm not enough, whenever I'm trying to rewrite a tape. It's from going from victim to responsible. And the word responsibility has got a bum rap, really, truly a bum rap. People think that responsibility is about blame, shame, fault, and duty. But the word responsibility is truly about empowerment and freedom. So if I take that thought, I am stupid, and I start thinking about things that I've done that have made me feel stupid, I can go to that place. Well, how did I create that situation? And when we answer that, how did I create it? We look at it as no blame, no shame, no fault, no duty. So how did I create something in my life that made me feel stupid because it's what I believe I am. I am stupid, so I'm going to create stupid. I'm going to create stupid actions because I'm going to feel stupid, so I'm going to act stupid. And so, if I were to take that example of what it is, then if I ask these four questions. How did I create it? Again, no blame, fault, or shame. And we can go through an example to answer the question. I don't know if you're up against the break, but so how did I create it? The next one is, what are the gifts and lessons? So if I take that and I can say, okay, what are the gifts and lessons? Okay, the gifts and lessons are that I just discovered how smart I am. Look at all the wonderful things I've done, you know, from this stupid thing that I did. What are some of the gifts and lessons? How can I, you know, learn something from it? How can I see that I am more than what I thought of originally? And you see the evidence, and then you start shifting that, right? And then the third question is, what's going to be different now that I know how I created it, now that I know the gifts and lessons? What's going to be different? Well, I'm never going to do that again, right? And then and we can go with a specific example so that we can see how we answer these questions. And then the last one is, how am I going to give back? Because I made such a stupid choice, and I know what the gifts and lessons are now and what I'm going to do different, how can I help someone for the greater good not repeat what I've done. And then I can go out and help somebody. That's where wisdom comes in. Do you have wise people in your life that you know to go to? That doesn't mean that they were perfect. It just means they learned from their growth opportunities, which most people call mistakes. Does that make sense, Peter?
Absolutely. And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Lillian McDermott. She's the host of the Lillian McDermott Radio Show and author of the new ebook available through her show, The 90-Day Challenge to Self-Love. We'll be right back after these messages. And we're back. It's Conversation here on 94 WIP. My guest this morning, Lillian McDermott, host of the Lillian McDermott Radio Show and author of the new ebook, 90-Day Challenge to Self-Love, available through her website. My name's Peter Solomon. Lillian, while we were on the break, it just occurred to me. What you're really talking about is not living your life for somebody else, for those people who gave you those negative messages, but living your life for yourself.
Yeah, and so what happens is we all want to be right. We all want to be right. So if the voice in my head is saying that I am stupid, which is the example we started talking about earlier, then I want to prove these people right. When I was 7 years old, I was told by my second grade teacher that I would never amount to much. I'm just giving you the abbreviated version of it. I was 7 years old. That seed was planted in my head. Then at the age of 10, I used to love to play the piano, and what happened was she discovered that I did not know how to read music. I would take my music to my sister, and I'd say, can you play this for me, Asia? And Asia would play it for me, and I'd go back, and I'd play it by ear. But then when I got to be to that next level where they're teaching us how to read, sight read, I could not read, and the teacher was so mean to me. She realized I didn't know how to read music, so she'd bang my fingers in the piano. And so I remember telling my mom, crying all the way home, saying I don't want to do piano lessons anymore. And so I remember my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, was visiting, and we saw she was a proper woman. She was a former teacher, and she came to me. We used to perform for our grandparents and for people that would come visit us. And so before she left for the day, my grandmother, who we all feared, she came to me and she said, Lily, I heard that you want to stop learning how to play the piano. And I said, yes, abuela, I don't want to learn. I don't want to go. I don't like piano, and I don't want to do it anymore. And she said, you know what? If you stop learning how to play the piano, I will stop loving you. Now, I know she was trying to motivate me, and I know that Mr. Torres in the second grade was trying to motivate me, but they motivated me in the wrong way. What they did was they planted a seed that made me feel like an unlovable, good-for-nothing person. And anything I did, Peter, as I was growing up, even if it was excellent and people saw me as successful, in the back of my head, I was not. It wasn't good enough, because I would never be good enough. And my first marriage ended because I thought I was unlovable, and eventually he was going to leave me. And you know what? You focus on, you manifest. And eventually he did leave. And so I had to take responsibility for these thoughts I didn't even know I was having. And so that thought in my head, it became part of my mantra. You know, I am healthy, I am wealthy, I'm wise, I am love. We change these mantras. I'm a creative, I am a creative, loving, intuitive, trusting leader. And so I had to relearn how to rewrite. That's the process of learning about myself and rewriting these tapes. I made them right. I didn't realize that that's what I was doing. And so I needed to learn what I wanted, not what people think of me. And that's where we get into trouble. We think more of what people think of us than what we think of ourselves. And we do it subconsciously, Peter. We don't even know that this is happening. These thoughts that are happening, we don't even know. So the only way that we can beat that is to be reconnected to what we want. And that's when we start thinking about, what do I want? You know, what do I want? And, in your life, Peter, did you ever start thinking about, you know, why am I doing this? What is it that I really want? Or do I focus on what? I don't want this. I don't want that. I don't want this. And you get more of what you don't want. So, you know, it takes a time. We have to stop and say, okay, you know what? I am enough to figure this out. I'm going to stop this vicious inner critic in my brain. Whoever this person is, let me find out. Let me discover. Let me be curious about who I am, who is tormenting me. Because we would never, ever, ever talk to a child the way that our voice in our head talks to us. Right?
Right.
So why are we doing this? If somebody treated me like I treated me, I would not be friends with them. And that's eventually what happens. We disconnect with self. We fill it in with things that really don't matter. And so once we stop the madness and say, I'm getting off this little hamster wheel, and I'm going to stop, and I'm just going to look at what are these thoughts, and what is it, you know, look at your past and say, these thoughts have manifested this life, but what kind of life do I want? How can I change it? And I'm going to work with myself and with a coach or a therapist or whatever, not to recreate my past, but to create the present I want. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. But then how do you let go of that past? That's where I get stuck.
Because okay, go ahead.
Because I will confess, I'm more of an I don't want this than I do want this kind of person.
Correct. Okay. So that's great. So then we answer the questions of responsibility. So I don't know how much time we have in this segment, but what the point is that there have been times in my life that I don't like what's going on. And maybe I will blame somebody else for what's going on. But the reality is, Peter, we can never change the other person, right? You've heard how many people does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is, or psychiatrists that look at the light bulb and say, how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is one, but only if the light bulb wants to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the reality of our life. How can I change these thoughts? So if you tell me, I also write for Florida Today. And so if you go to whenyouneedafriend.com and you go to the About Lillian, go to the articles I've written. I've written many articles. If you don't want to do the 90-day challenge, I've written many articles about what do I want. So, Peter, for you, if you're focused on what you don't want, stop. So say, what's the opposite of what I don't want? So I own a marketing company, and I bring ancillary services to doctors to help them with their practice. And so I went, and this is just a little example. I don't know if you can relate to this. There was a girl who was not feeling well. She was sick. And so she was coughing, and of course I know how powerful the mind is. And so she was like, I'm going to get sick. I know I'm going to get sick. And I said, well, if you keep with those thoughts, you are going to get sick. And so I said, what about if you change your thoughts? Well, first of all, vitamin C is awesome. I'm a chronic asthmatic since I was 9 months old, and I learned from Dr. Andrew Saul that if I took vitamin C, massive quantities, I could get off my medication, and I did it. I did it. If I believed I couldn't get off my medication, there would be nothing that could help me get off my medication. And I was on everything. I was on nebulizer treatments. I was on everything. And when he said that to me, I believed I could. And that belief changed the feeling of empowerment, and that feeling changed my actions to, gosh darn it, I'm going to go to my allergist. I'm going to tell him what I'm going to do. And he said, not without my blessing. And I was so determined, Peter, that I said, I am going to get off my medication. And I started taking vitamin C. As a matter of fact, this morning, before I got ready for your interview, I took some vitamin C, 5,000 milligrams this morning. I take it three or four times a day. And whenever I feel that, you know, I'm wheezy or something, I'm reacting to the environment. But if I would have believed that's ludicrous, I would have never even tried it. And I got off all my medications for asthma. Hmm. So the reality is our minds are so powerful. So if I don't, so I asked the girl, going back to the young lady, I've got off my little sidetrack here. So I asked the young lady, I said, if you feel that you're going to get sick, you're going to get sick. So how can you start a mantra, a new mantra What is the opposite of not getting sick? Do you know, Peter, she could not come up with the answer. So I said, how about say, I am well, I am healthy. And she goes, gosh, I never even thought of that. So I told her, get some vitamin C and start saying, I am well. Instead of focusing on, I feel pain, I feel sick, to say, I am well, all is well with me. I'm getting better in every way. So those are positive affirmations that can rewrite that tape that, you know, that girl had, or the tape that. So give me an example of what you focus on, what you don't want. Do you want to share that?
Well, I keep hearing the voice of my father in my head, who...
And what does he tell you?
You're stupid. You're fat. You're not an athletic. Nothing you do is good enough.
And did you make him right?
Yeah. A lot of times I did. And it's still hard not to make him right, and he's been dead a lot of years now.
Well, would you like to change that? Because I don't know if you know a great philosopher who's saying, I would do anything for, fill in the blank, but I won't do that. That's the part that gets me every time, but I won't do that. So what are you willing to do to get that voice out of your head, Peter?
I'm not sure what to do to tell it to shut up, because I can tell it intermittently to shut up, but it eventually comes back like the ghost of Christmas past.
Yeah, I know. So you make a plan. Now, do you have healthy habits, like maybe going to the gym, that's, you know, like walking, or do you have anything that you've been able to do that's positive for yourself?
Not really. I guess it sort of reinforces that position.
Correct. So what you do is, so if you, one of the things that I heard was, I'm not athletic. You know what? I was told I wasn't athletic, and I just recently had my DNA tested, and I discovered that I have a very, very athletic DNA. They actually said that to me, and I thought, oh my gosh, all those years. And so I was sharing this with my daughter, who was a competitive athlete all through college. Now she has a gym, but I told her that she could do this. I told her, you know, because I was told that I wasn't going to be loved if I did something that, you know, different, or, you know, I was told because I have asthma that I could never be athletic, right? So I never thought I could be athletic. And so when I was sharing this information with my daughter, who is athletic, the first thing she said is, Mommy, I got the gene from you. And I said, isn't that amazing that we have all these treasures in our bodies, but yet we don't discover it? Do you know, Peter, that only 5% of your DNA contributes to your health? Just 5%. You can turn it on or you can turn it off by the way you think, by the way you act, by the way you stress. And so you can start rewriting these tapes, like I said at the beginning of the show, just by putting that little tab. Like it sounds like to me, Peter, and I thank you so much for your honesty and trust, you know. You can put a little put that tab back into that tape recorder so that you and I can start recording these tapes. So if your father said that you were stupid, share with me the smartest thing you've ever done.
Smartest thing I ever did was move out of his house.
Okay. So how did you create that? Let's go there with a four question. Let's answer. So you moved out of his house, but you brought him with you, and you bring him with you everywhere you go, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So if the smartest thing that you've ever done is move out of the house, let's answer this. How did you create your relationship with your father? How did you create it? And that's the first question that's very hard. How did I create it? Which is the first question of taking responsibility. So let's see if we can start breaking these patterns. How did you create this voice in your head with your father? How did you create moving out? So that's the smartest thing. How did you create it? Tell me.
I knew I had to escape, and I was miserable at home. And I got a job and had an income that could pay a rent.
Correct. So you did that. That's great. You could have stayed there, but you chose to you chose to listen to your intuition that was screaming at you, get out. just like those Jason movies, Friday the 13th, get out, right?
Right.
He got out. So the second question of taking responsibility is, what are the gifts and lessons? What are some of the gifts and lessons that you learned from your father?
The gifts, a whole lot of negatives. I'm not sure of any positives.
Okay, perfect. He taught you what not to do. Isn't that brilliant?
Mm-hmm.
You can take what he did and turn it into, I will never do this to anybody else. And I don't know if you have children, but if I had to take the bullet for my child, I would take it. So if I had to take abuse in my body so that my child or my children, my four kids, didn't have to take it, then I would say it was worth it. I learned how not to be from that person. So when you take that, how you were smart, and you say, what are the gifts and lessons? I moved out of there, right? I moved out of there, and I learned I was enough. I figured it out. I've made a whole career about radio. Peter, you've done a great job. So you've proved them wrong right there. But then the voice in your head that are subconscious are not. They just keep going. You just need to stop these thoughts. Now you know that one of the thoughts that you have is that you're stupid. But you realize how smart you are and how intuitive, empathic you are. So then you can start focusing on that. So the third question is, what's going to be different? What's going to be different in my life? How are things different? How do you treat people, Peter, since you've learned that you are brilliant and intuitive? How did you treat people differently than your father treated you?
I try to be nice to them. You try not to judge.
Correct. Wow, that's a great gift. What a great quality to have, Peter, in someone. To be able to see the good and the beauty in others. But you took that poison. I heard Wayne Dyer say this, and I know this was not his quote, but I heard him say it. He said, it's not the snake bite that kills you. It's the venom that runs through your blood. So now that you're aware that you have venom running through your blood, there's so many different ways that you can get the antidote. And what is that antidote? It's to create a mantra that is empowering. Again, my generic mantra when I feel disempowered is, I am healthy, I am wealthy, I am wise, I am loved. Say that every day as many times as you can. Go back to that little, what's the earliest memory that you have of your father belittling you, Peter?
Oh, gosh. I was under 8, and he was mad at me because I did something I didn't like, and he was smacking me around.
He smacked you around.
Mm-hmm.
So if I could go back with you to that 8-year-old little boy, and I'm sure that if you go deeper, you can remember maybe that 3-year-old little boy being smacked around or that 1-year-old little boy being smacked around. How can you be your own hero at this moment and say, I'm going to protect you, little Peter. I'm going to protect you right now. What would you have wanted your father to do to you at that moment?
Would have been nice if he said he was sorry.
Okay. So can you talk to that 3-year-old or that 8-year-old and say, you are a brilliant young man. And yeah, you didn't get that from my father. But you're going to get it from me. You're a beautiful young man you're human. You learn from it. What did you learn from that? And you just have this conversation. Rewrite the tape. Rewrite the conversation that keeps playing in your head over and over again. And you be the hero. Don't expect it from your father. You be the man you wanted your father to be.
It really takes a lot of work.
Well, you're worth it.
That's true.
Aren't you?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. It's like people that tell me, because, I've interviewed world-renowned healers, teachers in the industry, food industry, and when people say, like, I am unwilling to do this because it takes a lot of work, then you're going to be choosing what you don't want. So for someone that is diabetic and is unwilling to give up fatty foods, animal products, sugar, I'm basically hearing, I am unwilling to give up disease. I am comfortable with my disease. I'm comfortable with my thoughts about my father. I'm comfortable with these thoughts. And so I don't want to change it. And until you feel I'm done with this, then it becomes less hard. It becomes a part of who you will become. Because you can rewrite these tapes at any time, Peter, at any time. But you would need to... You get to kind of going back and say, yes, it pain. You know what, Peter? And here's what I've been getting lately, and I think I'm going to write an article about this. People don't want to look at their past, but guess what? They bring it everywhere they go.
It's our baggage.
That's it. That's me carrying, you know, 50-pound of baggage everywhere I go is much harder than sitting there and having this conversation with 8-year-old Peter. And loving 8-year-old Peter, and giving 8-year-old Peter what he wanted as a child, and being able to start recreating and reconnecting with 8-year-old Peter, playing, having fun, being a kid, getting out there and discovering that, you know, play outside from till it gets dark. Don't come home until it gets dark. We all knew. We had our GPS system. We didn't have to be told when to come home. We knew when to come home.
And you're listening, right? And you're listening to Conversation. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Lillian McDermott. She's the author of the new ebook, The 90-Day Challenge to Self-Love. Be a part of the discussion. Give us a call. We have some time left for some questions on the landline. It's 1-888-729-9494, 888-729-9494. And on your cell phone, it's #94. 94. Lillian, how'd you get so smart?
I get so smart. I guess I had a bunch of teachers that taught me what not to do. And I also stopped fighting against my intuition. You're a very empathic person. And you pick up everybody's pain. And you pick up, I can tell that from you. You're a very caring, loving, wonderful human being that you keep trying to make your father right. You gotta stop that, right? We just gotta stop that. And so, it's not that I'm, you know, whatever, smart or wise. It's that I stopped fighting my intuition, and I started floating. I stopped fighting the current, and I laid on my back and went and enjoyed the flow of the river. And I did that right about 47 years of age. And so I've been working with this. You know, I started off working on myself, discovering, learning how to play with my inner child again, learning that I did create a lot of good things in my life. When I remarried, I married a wonderful person because I knew I didn't want to marry someone like that other person, right? So I made a decision of what I wanted, and I was blessed enough to have that opportunity. Now, I could have proved him right again by saying, you're going to leave me, you're going to abandon me, but I thought I can't continue doing this to myself. Although I was happy and most people thought of myself as successful, I discovered I could be happier and that I could have a better relationship. And when I met my husband, my current husband of 24 years, I met him 25 years ago, and when we decided to get married, we said, I just don't want to be married to you. I want to be happily married. So we made a decision that we wanted to be happy. Well, what does it take to be happy? Well, first, we have to change our thoughts about happiness. What does it look like? And create a plan. Create a plan. What would my life be like if I chose to be happy? This is what I would do. And start doing it. First, it's a thought, then it's the feeling, and then it's the action. Are we still on the air?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, but I didn't know if we were still on the air. But and so that's the choice that we make. We make a choice. I want to change and this is how I'm going to do it. I remember just recently I was invited, and I, totally unathletic, I was told because of asthma, I was totally unathletic, and I was invited, I was challenged to go on a hiking trip. Now, I said yes. I always say yes to life. Now, I always say yes to life because I have this sense of adventure that I squashed for many years. And so because I've got this sense of adventure, I said yes. And after I hung up this yes, I hung up the phone, and I said to my husband, you know what? I am going on a hiking trip. And he says, you've never even gone, you know, on a walk, let alone on a hiking trip, right? And so I said, well, I got to start thinking. All of a sudden, I started thinking about, oh, my God, this is going to take, I'm going to be off in the mountain. I'm going to be walking, and I'm going to be sleeping out with it. I've never done that. But then I said, what do I want? I wanted to experience that. So instead of being overwhelmed about going to the top of the mountain, I took little bite steps. I learned how to do this as a life coach, a certified life coach. I started using the stuff that I learned on myself, right? Because what's good of teaching others if you don't practice it yourself? So the first thing I did, guess what was the first thing I did instead of focusing on that mountain? I knew I was going to climb that mountain, but the first thing I did, guess what that was?
I have no idea.
I researched my boots, what kind of shoes I needed to wear. I didn't start at the top of the mountain. Then I started little by little. I bought my hiking boots. And then I went to the gym, which I frequent the gym quite a bit, but I started walking the treadmill with these boots. And then I started putting an incline. And then I knew I had to have 30 pounds on my back. And I inclined the treadmill so that I could have a backpack with 30 pounds on my back. And little by little, I started working towards that mountain. I didn't start at the top of the mountain. I started with the mall. And then when I got to the place where I felt, oh, my God, this is going to be, like, huge. I have no idea what I'm going to do. I just took my first step, and it just took 20 seconds of courage. That's it. It just took 20 seconds. I have 20 seconds of courage. Do you?
I think so.
Okay. So I mustered 20 seconds of courage, and then I took the next step and the next step. And 7 hours later, one of my goals was I was not going to go pee in the woods. If you go to my YouTube channel, I have my peeing in the woods video, and which, by the way, everybody goes to. So I label everything peeing in the woods because I want people to go back there and watch. But I was not going to pee in the woods, and that was the thing I told my friend Cheryl. But you know what? I got to that place where I got to the top of the mountain. It was getting dark, and then my fear of the bears at night was greater than peeing early. So I went and I peed in the woods. And so I little by little, if you just take a chunk, you know, and Peter, with you is those thoughts in your head, it becomes hard. Well, yes, if it's going to be hard, then it's going to be hard. If you think it's going to be hard, you're not even going to try it, right? Mm-hmm. But if you think it's going to be different and new, you can go and try. How can I love myself a little bit more? You know, what's something you've always wanted to do, Peter, and didn't feel that you could ever do it?
Lose weight and stay thinner.
Okay, well, I can help you with that. Listen to the Lauren McDermott radio show, and it's not about losing weight, but how about if you shift it and you say, I want to be healthy.
Okay.
I am healthy, okay? So then the next thing is consider. I'm going to challenge you. Like I was challenged at the beginning of my radio show career, about a year and a half into it, someone said, I challenge you to go raw vegan for 1 month. Raw vegan for my 1 month, I would never give up meat. Forget it. But I said, for 1 month, bring it. I can do it. 4 days after I started eating raw vegan, I felt so good. It wasn't that I was feeling bad. I was feeling better. So much better than ever. So I thought, well, if food can make me feel this good, what else is out there? And that's when my show changed 100% to living a responsible life, to living the life of your dreams. And that's what the 90-Day Challenge to Self-Love ebook is all about, the lessons I've learned from all these wonderful teachers that I've had. But do you know, Peter, that if you give me 1 month, you can start retraining what it is that you want as far as releasing weight.
Okay. And I'd like to say thank you to Lillian McDermott, her new ebook, The 90-Day Challenge to Self-Love. Lillian, your website where we can go and get information on the book.
They can go to whenyouneedafriend.com, and they can become a subscriber, and I'll send it to them for free.
Whenyouneedafriend.com. She's Lillian McDermott. You can't buy the book. You have to get into the website, whenyouneedafriend.com. Thank you, Lillian McDermott.
Thank you, Peter.
It's been my pleasure.
And mine too.
You're welcome. And it's been another edition of Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. We'll be back after these messages. Out of Conversation and into WIP Sunday here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. It's going to be a hot, humid WIP Sunday no matter where you go. But cool conversation coming up here. And when we come back in just a quick minute, many people know the Broadway play Grey Gardens. They may have seen the HBO movie with Jessica Lange and Drew Barrymore, or they may even have seen the documentary, Grey Gardens. Well, we have another perspective on that story as we welcome in just a bit Jerry Torre. He was the gardener to Big and Little Edie Beale, the residents of Grey Gardens, and his co-author, Tony Maeda. Mouthful there, Tony and Jerry are the authors of The Marble Faun of Grey Gardens. Grey Gardens, Big and Edie Beale, and a whole lot more coming up here on 94 WIP, the WIP time, 7:01. And we're back, with a fascinating story, the story of Big and Little Edie Beale, the residents of Grey Gardens, a decaying estate on Long Island, and their gardener, Jerry Torre, and his friend and co-author, Tony Maeda, authors of The Marble Faun of Grey Gardens. And before we begin, I should say this story has a circuitous tie back to Philadelphia in that there's a Bouvier Street, and Michael Bouvier, the great-great-great of whoever of Big and Edie Beale, emigrated from France to here to Philadelphia. Now let's say good morning to Jerry Torre and Tony Maeda. Good morning, guys.
Good morning. Good morning, Peter. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning. Jerry, what was your relationship to the Beals?
At first, I was a curious soul, and as a matter of fact, I still am very fascinated. But I was a trusted comrade. I was the first person in many 30 years, to be invited into their mansion and their lives. My relationship was based on trust and concern. I was loved by Mrs. Beale, and it was an honor to have been invited inside the mansion. My relationship was threefold. It was at first a home, and then I became a very dear person to Mrs. Beale, and she to I, and Edie as well. But no one understood why I was there. But our relationship was based on concern for each other, and it certainly needed my help, Mrs. Beale and Edie did, you know, with the conditions within the mansion. And, you know, it was just a loving relationship, Peter.
You worked as their gardener?
Yes. I was their assistant gardener. I was an assistant gardener down the street. And in one final day when I did discover the mansion, the following day I went to the property onto it and up to the door and introduced myself to Edie, who introduced herself and then said, "Mother, the Marble Faun is here." I didn't know who that was. I told that woman then. I didn't know her name was Edie. But I said, "You know, if you need any help with the property, you let me know, and I'll be more than glad to help you." I was so curious that I just wanted to be, I was polite, but I wanted to be also satisfy my curiosity. And Edie told me to come back the following morning, and I did, and I met Mrs. Beale, who immediately was gentle and kind to me, and I said, "How on earth did this woman wind up in this place with these conditions?" And it was just a contrary event. Anyway, we became the closest of friends, and actually I started referring to Mrs. Beale as mother, and that's the beginning of our relationship.
And what conditions did you find in Grey Gardens?
Well, the very first glance, it'll always be fresh in my mind. There was the diamond-shaped window panes aside the front door. It was a 28-room mansion. Mind you, not every room was grand. But I looked into the pane of glass. I cleared it a bit and then looked into the vestibule. There were cobwebs draped from banister to ceiling chandelier to tables in the vestibule. To the right, I couldn't make out what it was out through the window, but it was a library. I could see what looked like a piano, which indeed it was, and it was covered with cobwebs. And to the left, there was a dining room. Well, it was cluttered with, it looked like cat food or vegetable or fruit cans, but it was only cat food cans, stacked ceiling high. It also had, draped with cobwebs. Well, I was invited. I did go into the mansion that morning, and the moment the young woman, Edie, opened the door, well, the stench was rather overpowering, and my eyes were swollen with tears because of the ammonia-smelling cats. Well, that was all fine and good as far as they were concerned, but that took me time to adjust. And then, of course, I met Mrs. Beale on the second floor, sitting in what we call the sunroom, and she was the sweetest woman. She turned to me, and I stood there trying not to be polite and look around the room at the cattails and raccoons looking through the ceiling. And I said, and she said to me, "Oh, you have a beautiful face. You need to eat a boiled potato and a broiled piece of chicken and a green salad to maintain that face." Those are her words, Peter. I didn't think of it that at all. But she did, and that was the first spoken word to me, and I immediately felt very soft and comfortable with the woman, Mrs. Beale. And that was the beginning of our relationship. Very kind person.
It's an interesting story to me, though, on many different levels. One level is there's this decaying mansion with these two women, the aunt and the niece of cousin of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, living in genteel or maybe not so genteel poverty. How'd that happen?
How did that occur?
Yes.
Well, I believe there was threefold to that. I answered that way. Answers to that three ways. Well, of course, Mrs. Beale did like song and dance and theater, architecture and literature, everything it seems in the arts. Her husband, Mr. Beale, frankly, I think he had just not accepted her wanting to be an actress and a singer and or perform the arts in any way, as well as Edie, who absolutely loved it. It was sort of a carbon copy of Mrs. Beale, her mother. I believe after the last straw was at her son's wedding, Mrs. Beale did show up late, I believe I was told, 2 hours, dressed up as a opera singer from a Wagner opera. I'm not positive, I wasn't there, but the husband sort of had it, last straw moment, and then what happened was they drove home from the reception, and Mrs. Beale was driven by the chauffeur, and the car, he drove her into the driveway. He got out to exit, and Mrs. Beale then was exiting the car. That car stood in that driveway for 40 years, and I discovered it with the key still in the ignition, early 70s. That was one of the most fascinating sights, seeing an automobile abandoned, no less covered with vines and living cats in there. But then, of course, Edie was also, well, a woman of her own mind, and it wasn't accepted by a very conservative husband and father. And I believe that really began their demise. And then, of course, there was only so much money, Peter. Mrs. Beale and Edie did not have any money to pay a sanitation department to remove any garbage because it was all private. So what did they do? They tried burning their rubbish. They began storing it in cellar, kitchen, maid's dining room, library, living room. And it was years of a clutter, for sure. It wasn't unsanitary, for sure. But these women rose above it, and I love them, very proud of them still. You know?
It's sort of tragic, though, because the image we get from the documentary and from the HBO movie is one of two nutty ladies.
Oh, yeah, I know. If I could just interject on that one. I'll piggyback on what Jerry said about how it happened.
Thanks.
They were artists into their soul, and this was a time when women, particularly women of a certain stature in society, were not permitted to be artists, to be singers, to be dancers. It was looked down upon. So they alienated both, first Mrs. Beale, as Jerry talked about, coming to her son's wedding dressed as an opera singer, alienated the family to such an extent that they were basically ostracized and pushed aside and just taken care of, you know, out of sight, out of mind, given just enough money to barely survive. And when Jerry says there was no money, of course, there was money with the Bouviers and the Beals. However, when Mrs. Beale divorced her husband, she was given a very small allowance for Edie, but she had to live off of the allowance of her father's estate, which was controlled by her brother, Jack Black Bouvier, who, of course, was Jackie Bouvier's father. So you have these two women living on incredibly small incomes who don't know how to work, who've never been told, shown how to work. So, and that they just survived the best they could. And they really were kind of pushed aside, shunned aside, because of the fact that they were artists who had these dreams. They wanted to be artists, and it just was not allowed in that time period.
That's right.
Tony, what was your role in this whole process in the book?
Well, I was Jerry's co-author. I had seen Greg Garden for the first time probably about 20 years ago, like most people, on a DVD. I was absolutely blown away and fascinated by the Beatles, by Edie's and Mrs. Beale's eccentricities and their just individual. I couldn't get them out of my mind. I couldn't get the Beatles out of my head. And I was always fascinated by Jerry, too. I'm like, what is this young boy doing with these two kind of odd, eccentric, you know, I don't want to say crazy, but eccentric ladies in the middle of this crazy mansion in East Hampton? I mean, East Hampton is one of the most beautiful places in the world. You know, it's fascinated by me. And I was working on a project about the Mazel brothers, and I had a meeting with Don Mazel at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and there was Green Bay Gardens, and this guy comes up and starts talking, and I nudged my friend I was with, and I said, I think that's Jerry. And lo and behold, it was Jerry. And I met Jerry that night, found his stories fascinating. And the Mazel brothers project never worked out for me, but I couldn't forget Jerry. And then, I ran into Jerry a couple times, and we decided, let's do this. You know, I think your story, Jerry, is just as fascinating as the Beatles, and it's also inspirational. And after Jerry told me his story, I thought, I want to be a part of this. I want to help create something with you that will tell your story, maybe inspire other people. Because, Peter, his story is not just about Greg Garden. His entire life. It's a story of redemption. It's a story of overcoming so many hardships. He was a runaway teenager. He was an abused child. You know, I mean, he dealt with addiction. He's come through the other end, and he's an inspiration for other people. And I feel like that's the real story of the book, is that you can overcome anything. Like these women, they overcame all of these hardships and made their lives art. And Jerry overcame his hardships and made his life a wonderful example of giving and caring and sharing and inspiring others.
Now, Jerry, that's another important aspect of the book, in that is the family we're born into, we don't have a choice about. But the family we can create can be something truly beautiful, can it?
Amen. That's a great statement. It is true, of course. And Tony has been instrumental in helping get this book on the press. I mean, if it was not for Tony, I would have teetered out, because I'm not a co-author, and he is instrumental in helping me with this project, and it's very much our project now, and I like that so much. Yes, we are not responsible, of course, for who brings us into the world, and mind you, my father was a heavy-handed, difficult person, but he gave us everything, but he was very strict, And after his stint in World War II as a sergeant, I think that really changed him. My mother said it did. So he was just intolerant of anything that didn't agree with him. So I had to leave, and I did. I was young. I was a young teenager. But then I, you know, it was only through God's good grace that I discovered Mrs. Beale and Edie. I mean, first of all, it was a jungle getting to the front door, the porch. And then, of course, after that, that was an obstacle. But when I did, and I was invited the next day to come home, it was really just that, a home. Yeah, it was falling apart, and it was unsanitary. But there was so much humanity with the three of us. And you do see Edie and Mrs. Beale, and you would look after a film, any of those three mentioned, or the documentary, or the musical, and you would come back and say, these two women are a little nuts. But they really weren't nuts. They were just abandoned, and they were devoted. And in 40 years of isolation, I believe people drifted their own way of survival, and they had absolutely no choice, and theirs was the same plight I was. We shared so much of the same background. They were abandoned, and I abandoned my family because I could no longer deal with it. And I made my own world, and thankfully I met Mrs. Beale and Edie, Tony, and a whole bunch of great people that I have a very satisfying life, finally. But it's great. It's really cool.
And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP. We'll be right back after these messages. Stay with me. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. My guests this morning, Jerry Torre and Tony Maeda, co-authors of The Marble Faun of Grey Gardens. Jerry was the gardener at Grey Gardens for Big and Little Edie Beale, and Tony helped Jerry tell his story. Jerry, one of the things that made your father cranky was the fact that you were gay, correct?
I believe he knew that, yes. I also believe that the family knew, frankly and honestly, I was being assaulted by a relative and a neighbor. And I think the family actually knew that. And I was actually, unfortunately, sadly groomed to be abused as a child. And I was a kid. I think when the wind drifted around and they found out that this was occurring, no one came to my side and said to me, well, I'll make this quick, well, why didn't we stop him, or why didn't we help stop this assault on Jerry? They didn't do that. Instead, it was looked upon, I felt it was based on my behavior, where it was absolutely nothing to do with me. I couldn't tell A to Z, but this person could. And I ran from that because not only did I feel abandoned, but for the help I really desperately needed, but I ran from my father, who also just communicated physically. And I am not kidding. So I left. But, you know something, Peter? It's my prayer. It's my hope. And Tony's, too, that this book might reach out to people who are doing this, abusing people, mistreating children, or any number of things that I have had to deal with head on. Maybe this book will say to them, well, if this guy, Jerry, can do it, and he's doing well now, perhaps other people can do it, too. And it's just my only way of helping those who have no voice. And I hope it does reach those people. Yeah, that was my father, but let him rest in peace. There were many things he did wrong, but there's also many things he did right.
Sounds like you've forgiven him, and that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, yes, I have. You said it.
My question, though, is how did the ladies react to your background and your history?
Actually, you know, here's what happened. I kept, you know, don't say anything, don't ask, don't tell. That was what I did at Mrs. Beale's house and Edie's. I did not let the ladies know that I would, well, frankly, go to a gay bar on Montauk Highway in East Hampton. And it wasn't that I was all that crazed, promiscuous, whatever you want to call it. I wanted to be around people that I could relate to, and I did, of course, frequent these places. They didn't know. I didn't let Mrs. Beale ever know that I was a man of my own, and I also did not Mrs. Beal referred to an event. I went to my brother's wedding. I came back home, and Mrs. Beal asked me if any of the bridesmaids, you know, found me attractive and such. And I said, well, they're all married, because I got jammed. I didn't want to disclose then, because it was so close to it, that I was a homosexual man. And I did not want that to be known, because I didn't want to hurt their feelings. I didn't want to take the chance of being insulting, dear Mrs. Beal and Edie. So I just kept that to myself. And it wasn't that big a deal to keep it to myself, because it was my privacy that we all just... We all had our little privacies, and as we all should. So that's, I didn't let the ladies know. Nope. My private life.
Okay. The movie, the documentary, what was your role in that?
Well, I had been there some time, and then a woman called Lee showed up with these other people, Peter Beard, I found out his last name then long ago, 50 years ago. Lee came by to do a film about her life as a Bouvier in the Hamptons. Mrs. Beal, who was rich in vocabulary, was to narrate that film. And then Lee showed up, and it was tense most of the time between her and her cousin Edie. They show up, they start filming. 3 days later, Lee decides to shelve that footage. Now, it's just, Antonio will attest to this. It has just been released, and it's a fantastic step back into my life, 1971. The filming began. Lee abandoned that project. Sometime later, Albert David calls, and they ask Mrs. Beal, and I asked Mrs. Beal about if it would be a good idea to start a new film. And Mrs. Beal, Edie, was really ready to go with that, and so we did. Well, she did. He made the choices. And then, of course, the film you know now as Grey Gardens by Albert and David Maisels is present. But before that film, there was another edit, which was sort of like a cartoonish, and we didn't like it. It didn't look right. And so he changed the editing proposals and made it what you see today, Grey Gardens. Only 90 minutes of it, my friend. And people can take away from that film as they wish or ridicule it as they like. But the fact is there was a great deal more than just their quirky eccentricities. They were complete people, and they were completely unique indeed. You know what I mean? I hope.
I think so. Now, when you say a lady named Lee showed up, are we talking about Lee Radziwill?
Yeah. Lee Radziwill was Edie's cousin. Obviously, she was Jackie Kennedy's sister, so she was Edie's cousin, and she wanted to do basically a home movie about some of the time her pleasant places of her youth. She wanted to do a movie about East Hampton because she had grown up there with her sister and with her cousins, and they went. So she created this film, which is now called That Summer, which was thought to be lost for years, and then it was rediscovered, ironically or not ironically, when our book is out. Now there's a film out. It's kind of wonderful. With this footage showing Grey Gardens before it was Grey Gardens, I mean, this is, Jerry calls it vintage Grey Gardens, which basically means before the massive cleanup. The Grey Gardens that you see in the film Grey Gardens is after the cleanup, and it's pretty scary. So you can imagine what Grey Gardens looked like before the cleanup. And Lee and Jackie and Lee Radziwill and Jackie Kennedy and primarily Aristotle Onassis were really instrumental in helping get the house cleaned up. And Jerry, I think it's important to point out too, Peter, Jerry was unaware of the Beals' lineage. He just knew they were women in trouble when he first got there. He had no idea who the Bouviers were. He was a kid. He was 16, 17 years old from Brooklyn. So he didn't know who the Bouviers were. He obviously knew who the Kennedys were, but he didn't meet Jackie until one very interesting day on the grounds of Grey Gardens, which we talk about in the book, when he encounters the First Lady and realizes that she is the Jackie that Edie has been talking about all this time. It's quite a comical scene and really, really a lot of fun. But he wasn't aware of that at all. He just knew there were women who needed his help, and he was happy to be there.
But you have to wonder, at least I have to wonder, where were Jackie and Lee in terms of trying to make life better for their aunt and their cousin?
Well, that's the question. Where were Mrs. Beale's sons? I mean, you know, this is another thing.
Amen.
You know, there's another story in the book where Mrs. Beale's son, Phelan, calls, finally, after all this time, and Jerry doesn't know who he is because he's never contacted them. So you have to wonder about that. I believe that Lee and Jackie were unaware of the dire circumstances. I mean, you have to realize this, you know, they were going on through their own lives. Jackie was going through her own tragedies with the Kennedys, and Lee was, you know, marrying a prince and having her life with Truman Capote. So they really were unaware until they decided to do this project. And I think that's what really opened their eyes to what was going on. And then once they found out, you know, to be totally fair to them, and you can see it in the film that summer, they are really instrumental in getting the place inhabitable. But that's a question, you know, that's one of the big mysteries and one of the fascinations about this book is, where were the family? Where were Mrs. Beale's sons? You know, why were they allowing their mother and their sister to live this way? It's quite an interesting question.
Any theories, guys? Any theories about why they were allowing them to live like that?
Oh, any theories? I believe that they were their sons' children. I mean, Mr. Beale... was Phelan Beale, Mrs. Beale's husband, was very conservative, staunch, as Edie says, you know, staunch Republican banker. And he they very much followed in their father's footsteps. I think they were also very embarrassed by their mother, and they got very embarrassed by their sister. And they just let it go. I mean, Jerry can probably speak to that as well. Jerry had that phone conversation with Phelan and had many encounters with the Beals and with the brothers and didn't find them the warmest people in the world, right, Jerry?
No, you said it, but unfortunately true. Indeed, Phelan, well, at the time the phone was ringing off the hook, it was resting between the beds in the center bedroom. And, of course, it was a roasty day, hot. Mansion was untidy, phone's ringing, and then finally I said to Mrs. Beale, may I answer the telephone? Mind you, I was a cranky teenager that day. And the fellow answered, and he said something like, hello, I'm Phelan, and how are you feeling, and something. And I was cocky, and I said, no, we're not feeling too good around here, and I just hung up on him, because I thought... there was another crank call. We had plenty of them. And stones being thrown at the northern section of the mansion. Lots of vandalism. But it wasn't how are you feeling. It was, I am feeling. And then I said to this man, said something about us feeling something. And Mrs. Beale said, oh, that's much my son. And Edie took the phone from me after it rang. And I said, nothing more. I was actually embarrassed. I didn't recognize, nor did I know of their heritage. I didn't know Mrs. Beale was related to Mrs. Onassis until sometime later, from 71 to 70-something. We were just friends, and I loved them. It didn't matter. Frankly, it still doesn't matter. What matters is that they were people, and they needed to be cared for. And they had the family and the funds to do that, but that didn't happen. And Tony's on the point. I will not understand ever why not. A few grand, a little bit of help, some proper heating, and definitely good food. That did not occur, and when it did, it was temporary indeed. Well, Mrs. Onassis showed up. Should I tell you this?
Please.
Oh, I was having a cigarette on the front porch. I never dare smoke inside the mansion. Obviously, the house was a tinderbox. And it didn't like me. I wouldn't be disrespectful to either women and having a cigarette in front of them. So I went outside, which I often did for a cigarette. And I'm sitting on the front porch, and a car pulls up outside on the roadside. And I get up, and I walk to the grass. And I put my cigarette out in the grass. And it's roasting hot again, and I look up, and this woman leaves this automobile. The chauffeur opened the door, and I just, as the woman walked closer to me, I got more uptight and more nervous and almost thought it was a mirage. because only 10 years earlier or so, I saw this woman in an automobile in Dallas, and I remember the nun saying, kneel aside your desks and pray for the president. He has been shot. We were sent home that day in 64, whatever year it was, 63. I'm standing in the front porch area in the grass, and Mrs. Elnaz is walking towards me. And, of course, I recognized her because of the photographs in the newspaper. And it was indeed Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. And I just was disbelief. And I looked like, well, dirt bomb and had dirty clothes. Edie opened the second floor boy's bedroom window and is yelping, don't let her in here. Your mother's mother will not like that. You'll never, so-and-so threats about my getting back to their friendship. I didn't let Mrs. Onassis. And Edie did come down the stairs to the vestibule. They had a heated, let's say, powwow on the porch. I didn't go near the two ladies. I was relieved that Mrs. Onassis went over to Edie. But before she did, she took off her, she had really round glasses and a kerchief, typical of what Jacqueline always seemed to look like, Mrs. Onassis. And she glazed the front of the mansion up to the boys' peaks. I could see, watch her eyes and her emotions on her face. She was in disbelief of what she was standing in front of her. The mansion, it looked like the Adams family's house. It was really overgrown, quite interesting, in fact. But that was it. That was what I realized. Mrs. Beals related to Jacqueline Kennedy of Onassis. And it just got richer and richer. I spoke with Mr. Onassis on the telephone and so on. Mind you, look, I'm a regular person. I'm a regular guy from Brooklyn. So this was all like a tidal wave off the beach, and it kept coming. It kept happening more and more fascinating as time passed. So that was my encounter with Mrs. Kennedy Onassis.
Amazing. And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP. Guys, stay with me. Got to run some more commercials. We'll be back in just a bit.
Okay.
And we're back and into the home stretch here on 94 WIP, WIP Sunday, with Jerry Torre and Tony Maeda, co-authors of The Marble Faun of Grey Gardens, talking about the Beals, Big Edie and Little Edie, the films, the musical comedy, and a whole lot more. My name's Peter Solomon. Jerry, when did Big Edie die?
February 5th, 1977, and it was 3 days in Southampton Hospital. Reluctantly, of course, without knowing, actually, Mrs. Beal was had to be taken to the hospital, and it was a terribly cold winter at that time, that year, and that's what the year of Mrs. Beal's passing and the day.
And how about Little Edie? Was she still alive?
No, Edie was still alive, and I, of course, was, and well, Edie went to the funeral, and that was a whole history in itself. Excuse me. Of course, Edie was alive, and 2 years to the, almost the day of the funeral, Edie did finally sell the mansion and took off for many destinations, including Montreal, Oklahoma, New York City, not in that order, and then, of course, Ball Harbor, Florida. And that's where she passed away alone. She was three to five days alone, had passed away. And God bless her. That's the, yes, she was alive, and we had a somber funeral, only a limited party of people, including Mrs. Onassis, the brothers, I think John Kennedy escorted his mother. And I'm not sure because he looked so young, but I know that Lois there was there, and that was a very sad moment. It was the ending of the most magical period of my life, and it just takes me back when you ask me that question. Excuse me.
Now, the reason I ask is because obviously they were both gone when the HBO movie happened and when the Broadway play happened.
Right, yeah.
What were your reactions to those two things?
Tony?
What was your reaction to the play and the movie?
My reaction?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, both of us. You can go ahead, Jerry, then I'll chime in.
Oh, okay. You know something, Peter? It all, there has to be a reason. It must be an energy. Well, reaction began the first moment I was reunited with Albert. Before that morning, I was in my cab in New York City at 9th Avenue and 45th Street. Passing, the red light was there. There's a customer on the other corner. She had a camera and a tripod. Anyway, I didn't stop, pick her up, and took her to a destination. On her, the way to that destination, I said, do you know much about films? Are you in the film industry? Just wanted to make talk. I wanted to speak with my customer. It's always a good practice to do that when you have a stranger in the back of your cab. So that was a theory of a way I've done things. And this woman said yes, and I said this, you know, Great Gardens, the long of it all is that she did, and she was fascinated to find me asking her that because she did find it amazing that I, Jerry, was now driving a cab, and she said, you need to get back with Albert Maysles. And I did following morning, call him, and then went over there. He told me they were making a play, doing a play about Mrs. Beale and Edie. We laughed a little bit because we said, how on earth would anyone do that? And indeed they did. The history up to the musical was really cool. I went to a reading. A man there in the reading was playing me. His name was Matt Cavanaugh. A good-looking guy and everything. And I was honored. I was flattered that they even wrote a song, a little bit corny but touching, about me. I was honored. Mrs. Beale and Edie had finally been able to reach the venue in which they saw it all the years I was witness to that. And it was a little bit uncanny, but it was remarkably artistic, and it was a bit comical. Yes, Peter, it was true, but it was also for me a bit taking me home, a little bit sad, because I see the people performing and want very much it to be the real people I love, but it wasn't. It was a musical theater, and it was charming, and I was honored.
I think one of the most amazing things about the musical is the fact that the musical was created some almost 30 years after the initial Greg Gardens film. That's the thing about this story. It is timeless. It just keeps going. I mean, we're talking about the Beatles in 2018, and this all happened in the 70s. It's pretty remarkable that this story has such life. Clearly, it touches so many people. It's one of the great stories, I think, of our time. These women, I mean, people just don't understand the, you know, there's the question of how they ended up that way, but there's also the joy that they got out of their lives, which I feel comes through in the musical. And what's amazing about the musical is that these are two women who wanted to sing. I mean, they kept asking Albert and David for more songs, and they wanted their movie to be a musical. And some 40 years later, you know, they got their wish, and the musical exists, and it's a great testament to their love, as Jerry said, of performing and what they always wanted to do and what they always wanted to have people think of them as, these musical singer, dancer, these great performers. And that's what happened, and that was pretty remarkable.
I would imagine, too, they would have been incredibly proud about the musical winning the Tony Awards that it won.
Exactly, yeah. And how about those performances? I mean, Christian Ebersole and Mary Louise Wilson, amazing performances, and captured the essence of the Beatles so well. And there have been some other performances. I saw Rachel York do it in Los Angeles. She was brilliant. And Betty Buckley playing Mrs. Beale. Jerry went to a showing in Sag Harbor of the musical with Betty Buckley and Rachel York. And also, blown away. These women would be so honored. You know, Edie said, you know, she didn't want anyone to play Edie Beale but Edie Beale. But she has to be pretty flattered, some of the people who've taken on her role, her persona.
How about the HBO movie?
Well, the movie, unfortunately, we were not crazy about the movie. The HBO movie, I think that Jessica Lange and Drew Barrymore did amazing performances. They were fantastic. There's no Jerry in the HBO movie. For whatever reason, that was HBO's decision, and we don't really have much to say about that.
Shame on them.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah. You know.
Jerry, at some point you won't be here anymore. Let's face it, we're all going to get old.
Oh, I'm already there.
Okay. What do you want people to think about your experience that's told in The Marble Faun of Grey Gardens and the movie?
Thank you for asking that sensitive, wonderful question. Thank you, Tony. To begin with, Tony is the backbone of the book. He put it in the order it needed to be said, it's written. I would hope that a person, again, who would read this book, say, gee, he was really had a really ridiculous, if any, childhood at all, which is still haunts me because it was wrong, very. I would hope that people might get away from it, leave it and say, well, I'm drinking too much liquor. I want to stop and be happier. Or I'm mistreating someone in my life, and I want that to stop. And it can stop. Look at it, what it did. Even this fellow rose above all of that mistreatment. Maybe I can do it the same. Maybe I'll stop. I wanted to enlighten people, to let them know that even through the rubbish and the dysfunction of Grey Gardens, there was life, and it lived on, and it still lives on. That the very venue of song and of dance is present today. It's just an amazing legacy of a tribute to devotion and determination and to a better way of living, to perhaps dropping all these unfortunate events in your life and leaving them in the past and sustaining a new, fresh life with a realism. And also, you know, get people out of the messes that we make or others make for us. So my hope is that it would help a young man or woman and reach. And also, you know, of course, Mrs. Beale and Edie Peter for years have been misunderstood. I have to avoid some of the groups online that actually make comments that are actually incorrect and hurts me, because there's, you know, like you said, you see a film, but 90 minutes of it, and you think, well, these people were this and that, but in fact, they were not. And I'd like very much people to know the inside story, so therefore the book is now present. And that, again, is another hope. It's, you know, I think Tony might understand what I mean.
Yeah, I think that Jerry, he speaks so eloquently about it. We've always looked at the book as a story of, I always think of Jerry as like the prodigal son coming home, and it's so important. You know, he went through all of these incredible adventures in his life, his own personal demons, struggles with addiction, as we said, and then the abuse he received, and he found this home, you know. And you said it earlier, Peter, very, very eloquently about, you know, the families that we are born into versus the families that we make. And this was his home. Grey Gardens, you know, may have been this haunted house to so many people, but to Jerry, this was home. And after he goes through many of these struggles in his life as an adult and has all these adventures and deals with addiction and AIDS and losing his entire network of friends in the 70s and 80s, and he survives, he comes back and he reclaims himself and reclaims his identity. And to me, that's really what the book is about. It's about a man coming to terms with himself and his life and reclaiming himself and very much going home. You know, in addition to giving these women a voice that they haven't always had in the past, Jerry's absolutely right about how cruel the internet can be. It's amazing how cruel people can be when they have anonymity behind them. But the misconceptions about these women, and Jerry felt very strongly about setting that straight, many, many things, setting that straight, that these women were living, breathing, wonderful women. And yeah, they were eccentric and a little crazy sometimes, but who isn't? Considering what they had to deal with in their lives, I think they were pretty sane.
Absolutely. What happened to the house? I know you said Little Edie sold it, but does it still stand today?
It's glorious. Ben Bradley originally bought it, the famous West Washington Post editor, Watergate, incredible guy. He bought it, he and his wife, and they completely rehabbed it. It is today one of the most glorious, glorious houses in East Hampton. It just recently was for sale. There was a big to-do in East Hampton last summer, I believe. Wasn't it, Jerry? Didn't you go?
I didn't go. I couldn't have gone. It would have broken my heart.
Yeah, that's true. Yes.
Frankly and sadly, a tag sale there.
A tag sale,
2,000 people. I don't mean to overspeak you, Tony.
No, go ahead.
You know, There was a tag sale at the mansion after Miss Sally Quinn, sold it to a family. I'm not sure of their name. I think they want to remain confidential. They had a tag sale. They didn't attend it. They were selling everything and more from the mansion, and they did. They sold everything. I couldn't have handled that. It would have been really like the carpet baggers from the Gone with the Wind. It was heartbreaking for me. I didn't go, but they did sell it currently, presently. I mean, it is under reconstruction again, and it's on I-beams lifted off the ground, the earth, and they're digging in a complete cellar underneath it for practical reasons, support the foundation, so on. And they plowed all the grounds around it, so it looks like it's going to be just a lawn, maybe a little bit of a walled garden, but it is safe and sound and being rebuilt. And yes, Sally Quinn bought it, and I tell you, Edie stayed at that mansion 2 years, practically to the day of Mrs. Beale's passing, and sold it to that woman, Sally, for, well, I know the $230,000. What's the difference if I tell you the price or not? It's not my business, but it's yours now. And I don't have that kind of, never did, but they did, and that's what they sold for, with lock, stock, and barrel.
Sally Quinn and her husband, Ben Bradley, really made it a glorious, glorious place. I mean, Jerry goes back there in the book. He revisits it, and it's pretty remarkable. When I was there, you just stand there and you think, oh, my God, this is Grey Gardens, because it's just, it was just a glorious place again.
Big Edie and Little Edie certainly would be proud, and maybe, just maybe, the house is haunted a little bit. Mm. So I like to think they're still there.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they are.
May I make quick mention of a photograph, please?
Very quick.
There was a garden party one afternoon. A woman took a photograph of the second floor where there was once the children's nursery, and that was in perfectly good condition, but just cobwebbed. The photograph of that room upstairs, second floor, she had it developed, brought it to the musical. There was Mrs. Beale and Edie looking out the windows from in that photo, like a shell of a ghost.
Two ladies.
They were I don't know if they photoshopped it. I don't think so. It was just too exceptional. And I didn't ever get a copy of that photograph, but I believe they were looking out at the lawn party through those windows. I wish I could only share that photo with you.
That's beautiful. It's
amazing, Tony. The two ladies are looking out at the poolside area. And now there's a pool. There was a pool there anyway. And there they are. And I was so astonished to see that image. I do believe they're still in the mansion. I surely do. Hopefully I'll go back and speak with the ladies again.
Hopefully. And I'd like to say thank you to Jerry Torre and Tony Maeda, authors of The Marble Faun of Grey Gardens. Thank you for the memories, guys.
Thank you, Peter.
Oh, my pleasure.
You're welcome. And thank you, Tony.
And thank you as well. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sunny Hill. Always interesting and provocative discussion in the living room. Your reactions, I know I'll be listening. Thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and Tideman Solomon, associate producer. Nothing left to say, but see you soon.